You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
In 2022, the Conversion Practices Prohibition Legislation Act amended the Human Rights Act 1993 to make conversion practices unlawful in Aotearoa New Zealand. A new study, Conversion Practices in Aotearoa New Zealand, Developing a Holistic Response to Spiritual Abuse, highlights support needed for people wanting to escape conversion practices in faith-based settings. Led by Director of Kaitiaki Research and Evaluation and Adjunct Professor at Victoria University, Dr. Michael Rogalski, the study identified interventions required to ensure those experiencing religious conversion practices have a pipeline to safety. I spoke to Rogalski about the study, beginning our interview asking him about the research process.
So we recruited through the Human Rights Commission and then via social media through snowballing, looking at anyone who identified as either gender diverse or same-sex sexual orientation. And we're asking people who had had experiences of religious conversion practices, more popularly known as conversion therapy. And we had a diverse range of participants from transgender, non-binary, same-sex orientation. And we first of all just really thank the participants for their courage and coming forward and sharing their narratives. It's been amazing. So what I did was I sat down and I did a discursive analysis of that, looking at the way that the various similarities and differences occurred between participants. Mm. And that showed a number of things that were relatively new to the literature. And one of the first was that internationally, people have generally referred to harm associated with conversion therapy and conversion practices. And our participants were like, nah, we've got to stop that. What this is spiritual abuse. And I think where people are coming from there is, if you see something as abuse, such as spiritual abuse, it elevates it to a point that demands intervention, it demands action. So I think that's the first really, really important finding. The second finding that's different is internationally, people have generally focused on harm associated with conversion practices, and they've also focused on prevalence. Very few studies have looked at what people need. So participants said, they used the metaphor, a pipeline. We need to create a pipeline to safety for people who are within these, what I would call toxic environments, to coming out. But also don't assume just when someone comes out that that's it. They need support in the short term, but often a lifetime of support to recover from the various forms of abuse that they've encountered. So that was really, really cool. And I can talk more about the pipeline if you're interested. The third was that, well, part of the pipeline is that participants said, like, we need an agency, someone that can coordinate the pipeline but assist people with recovery. And we've got to remember that when you're in these environments of harm, to leave these environments, you're leaving your family, your loved ones, your friends, but also your faith behind. And it's really, really common for, well, my participants, and I'm a survivor myself, but when you leave, you don't have a bank account, you don't have a job, you don't have often formal education, and you certainly don't have networks that can you can call on for housing or anything. So it's not uncommon to hear about people who are homeless, who are desperate, who are suicidal, who are just hungry. And so what people are saying is that we need an agency who can, one, first of all, develop a strategy to bring life into this metaphor of a pipeline and then provide that type of support.
Yeah, and just to kind of go back to what you were saying there, you made it really clear that religious conversion practices should be identified as spiritual abuse. Why is it so important to make that distinction from other forms of harm, and what is the difference between other forms of harm and spiritual abuse? Could you kind of talk a little bit more about that?
So when people have talked about conversion, generally the research looks at conversion therapy, which has included things like chemical castration, electric therapy, aversion therapy, pretty horrendous stuff, but also talk therapy, you know. But within all of this is that the key messages is that this individual, I am not okay. And people internalize that, and that has manifested in high rates of suicidality, self-injurious behavior, lifelong mental health challenges from PTSD, major depression, anxiety. Tamir. So that's what they've called harm. And why people have said that, yes, it is harmful, but there hasn't been an action to create change. By viewing it as spiritual abuse, participants and myself strongly believe that as soon as you call something abuse, it demands action from government, from communities, from survivors, from faith-based organisations.
Yeah, and you've also, you said before that research has focused more on conversion practices and its prevalence and the harms caused by that, rather than what is required for support. Why do you think there's been an absence there? Would you say that maybe in making conversion practice unlawful in Aotearoa in 2022, the focus of research on this topic may be witnessing a bit of a shift?
Definitely. There aren't that many countries in the world that have criminalised conversion therapy or conversion practices.
Mm.
And so it's sort of been, the whole discourse behind it has been, hey, let's create change by coming up with a prevalence statistic to show how common this is and focus on the harms. And by focusing on the harms and prevalence, if we can use this information to lobby for change, then maybe that we can get some sort of legislative change. So that's why there has been that sort of focus. But because New Zealand, we have had some, as you said, in 2022, the decriminalisation of conversion therapy, now we're in that position to sort of look at what sort of support is needed.
Yeah, and what currently exists for survivors, what support currently exists for survivors of conversion practices? Do you think that they are adequate?
Very little exists, and even when you look at ACC legislation. So a lot of us are familiar with ACC legislation in terms of sensitive claims. There is, depending on who views that legislation, it could be argued that someone of conversion practices may be eligible for that type of psychotherapeutic support. But that needs to be clear. And basically, no. People have been rejected for that type of psychotherapeutic sensitive claim support. It's really, really hard to get support. So the study found that there are some frontline people, you know, the people that you come in contact in your daily life that you are more likely to share your narrative with, your need, your pain. And those could be nurses, medical doctors, teachers. But people don't, those three professions don't really understand. They haven't had training on the impact of this type of abuse. Participants called it either cult-like abuse or actual cult. And so there really needs to be an awareness raising about how to deal and respond to someone when they come to you and say, actually, this is my background. I really, really need help.
Yeah. And just going back to your research there, could you talk us through what you identified as key interventions for that pipeline to safety for these people? What do you believe is required to support survivors?
So first of all, participants were really clear we need an agency to be developed. And they were saying, hey, there's an opportunity for here. This agency should comprise of survivors, faith-based organisations who are leading the way in trying to provide support and intervention for survivors, but also the state. But they were saying the state needs to walk alongside survivors and the faith-based organisations and not be the leader, okay? And I think that was really important. The other part of that was that a number of participants were saying it's time for faith organisations to stand up and acknowledge the pain that has been caused and that they need to lead the way in creating these safe places. So once that agency is established, we need to establish a strategy about what a pipeline looks like. And people are really, really clear that we need to, that pipeline needs to go into communities to provide awareness raising for people so that in the individual's time and according to when they want to, they know how to leave and that they are provided with support. The type of support that they were talking about, participants were talking about, was basic needs from housing, getting a bank account, getting into education, training, getting jobs, being around peers who understand what it's like to come out of these toxic environments, being channeled or funneled into the right type of psychotherapeutic support. And don't assume that this is just short term. If you've had a lifetime of abuse, of spiritual abuse, you can expect a relatively prolonged period of time for recovery. So these interventions need to be seen as long term.
And just last question here. The study primarily included Pākehā participants. As Māori and Pacific peoples often feel like their culture and faith are inextricably linked, for example, do you think that what has been identified here is required support is applicable to other cultures as well?
Definitely. And because of the great thing that since we've released the research, I've had such a cool opportunity to talk to a variety of groups from diverse cultural groups. And the findings that have been, I think it's been validated that it can be generalised. And the biggest thing here is being safe and being told that it's okay to have your faith, but we've got to draw a line between when someone's faith is abusive towards another. And I guess that's one of the other things that participants shared. I was really, even though I'm a survivor, I guess when I was hearing people's narratives, the compassion that participants had was amazing. And it was this really interesting position to be in. It's like, yes, please, we encourage you to have your faith, but can we please just stop abusing people who don't fit in with your heteronormative reality? And so what participants were saying was, there's got to be a way to create dialogue between faith organisations and those of us who understand the impact of abuse to show that, hey, it's when you preach this stuff from the pulpit, when you create these types of negative environments, that pain is internalised and can result in a horrendous array of things, including suicidality. So it was really interesting. So when I talked earlier about creating an agency, one of the key things, apart from the provision of a pipeline to safety and provision of basic care and psychotherapeutic support, is leading the way in terms of a dialogue to let those who are engaging this negative type of ideology to see the impact of the words that we see as hate coming from the pulpit.
That was Dr. Michael Rogalski speaking about his research article, Conversion Practices in Aotearoa New Zealand, Developing a Holistic Response to Spiritual Abuse.
Is it too late in the process, though, to change that?
Nothing's too late, bro. Everything's made up in politics.
The Wire.
I also spoke to lived experienced and human rights advisor Andrea Famasanga about how Te Kahui Tika Tangata, the Human Rights Commission, provides support to survivors of conversion practices and the importance of this. I firstly asked him to introduce himself and describe what his role was at Te Kahui Tika Tangata. Here is their interview.
So I was employed by the Human Rights Commission for 5 years, including leading the Conversion Practices Response Team, which was a time-focused team due to funding. And during that time, I was able to meaningfully leverage my lived experience as an ex-pastor, a survivor of conversion practices in the context of coming from a religious Samoan home in Lower Hutt, with a family that loved me, but nonetheless, I was still exposed to conversion practices. And while I no longer work for the Commission, these days I'm an independent lived experience advisor on human rights, including supporting Te Kahui Tika Tangata, the Human Rights Commission, to engage with conversion practice survivors alongside other survivors such as Dr. Michael Rogalski, who led the research we're going to talk about today.
And yeah, so I've spoken to Dr. Michael Rogalski this morning about the research itself, but would you be able to kind of speak to a little bit about what the Human Rights Commission's involvement was in this project?
Sure. The research was commissioned by the Human Rights Commission when it had funding to expand our existing civil redress scheme, received under the government's passing, received when the then government passed the Conversion Practices Legislation Act. But essentially, the Commission wants to understand experiences of conversion practices survivors in New Zealand, and we wanted the peer-reviewed evidence-based research that would help us know what support people who are experiencing conversion practices needed to escape the religious abuse and spiritual abuse they're experiencing as a result of conversion practices before, during and after they leave. And those findings would help inform the Commission's services to respond to conversion practices, as well as helping other organisations know how they can support survivors who are caught in the throes of conversion practices.
And to kind of add on to what you're saying there, as you say, the Conversion Practices Prohibition Legislation Act 2022 amended the Human Rights Act 1993 to make conversion practices unlawful and allowed the Commission to receive and handle disputes and complaints. Would you be able to talk us through a little bit about what the process for handling these looks like? How does the Commission support survivors?
Sure. Well, the Commission under legislation has an inquiries, a free inquiries and complaints system, which is also disputes resolution that can also lead to mediation. But essentially, if someone believes they're experiencing conversion practices, they can pick up the phone or an email the information services team, and they will receive free, confidential, independent, impartial advice about what to do with their query. And that person on the phone, through talking to them, will know whether it's an inquiry that can be facilitated through the commission, or if it's a complaint that will go through the police, who under that same legislation have powers to investigate or look at an alleged conversion practices complaint as well. What people need to know is that if you don't know for sure, but you suspect that you could be experiencing conversion practices or someone else's, that you should call the Human Rights Commission anyway. The staff there on the phone have been doing this for a long time. They run a service that is trauma-informed, survivor-centred, and they can answer questions that someone might have. After answering those potential questions, and that's something that can be handled by the Human Rights Commission, they can undergo mediation and disputes resolution, which they will help determine, and it will be very responsive. We know that some of the needs of survivors are quite different when it comes to conversion practices. They might want to just stop this practice from happening. Regardless, the people at the commission can help you. And then it can also go through to a disputes resolution. And in some cases where that can't be handled there, it can go all the way through to the Human Rights Review Tribunal, and the person there or the complainant can apply for legal representation at the Office of the Human Rights Proceeding.
And has the way the Commission provides support to survivors of religious conversion practices changed since these practices were made illegal? And do you expect that they will adapt again after Rogowski's research?
One of the things that we always knew when we set up the team and to help inform the Commission's response is that it really needed to be trauma-informed and survivor-led and sensitive. So that means right from the beginning, we knew that we needed an approach that was not going to turn survivors off. We needed to really understand the dynamic and sensitive relationships that some survivors have with people either in family, religious or cultural settings. So many of the things that the researchers revealed are things that the Commission had already incorporated into their response, but this research has given evidence that that approach must be maintained. And yeah, and we need to strengthen that approach in light of this research. So that means being understanding of some of those dynamics that are occurring to people that are experiencing conversion practices in religious settings. Some of the new framings that this research talks about is religious and spiritual abuse, and it even talks like the metaphor of being like in a cult and how hard it is to escape those conversion practices. So because of that, the Commission has always been aware of that. Now we have the research to back that up. The Commission is always trying to create a service that doesn't make it too hard for complainants to understand what people are going through, as well as the choice to maintain some of those relationships if they choose, but being very clear that those harmful practices do need to stop and making sure that we've got a service that is responsive to that.
And you yourself came out as gay in your 40s after 15 years of conversion practices and a decade working as a pastor. If you'd be comfortable speaking about that, what support did you receive coming out of that period of your life?
Yeah, well, to be honest, I wish this research and the work that the Commission has done since this legislation was passed was available to me, because I really feel like that would have helped me. It would have helped me identify that what I was experiencing was wrong, that what I was experiencing was tantamount to religious and spiritual abuse. So unfortunately, I didn't have some of those support systems. I really had to look around and look at other people's testimonies of how they exited. Mind you, I was a pastor and my livelihood depended on maintaining some of those conversion practices, because that's what I believed, that's what I was taught to believe, and looking back now, it's actually what I was indoctrinated to believe. And there was a real dearth of information there. Like, there wasn't, like there is now, this really wonderful source of conversion practices, testimonials and survivor stories that sort of gave me a sort of an exit plan and strategy. So that's why this research is so helpful, because it will give voice to people who are essentially voiceless and don't have the power to exit those practices. The Commission has produced a number of different guidance that exists on the website. Today, if you visit their website, tikatangata.org.nz, you'll see different guidance there, not only for religious settings, but for people who are experiencing conversion practices now, how to exit them. And the Commission's also got a report coming out soon on conversion practices in New Zealand, according to many survivors. And that type of report, those types of stories will go a long way in helping people understand what they're going through and also how to exit those.
Can we touch on a little bit more about what areas do you expect this report to cover following on from Rogowski's research?
Yeah, the report that the Commission will release later is one of the first reports of its kind in New Zealand, because what it does is it really emphasises the survivor voices and the insight. What it does is it looks at survivors at the intersection of ethnicity, those who are Takatāpu Māori, those who are Pacific, those who come from ethnic backgrounds, and more than just looking at religious settings, which this wonderful research that we've got currently does, it expands that to actually look at conversion practices in healthcare settings and family settings and also cultural settings as well. Mm. And it makes a number of recommendations to governments, to communities, to religious settings and cultural settings about what everyone must do to help eliminate conversion practices in Aotearoa New Zealand. I would just like to say that this report that's been released is so useful, but it will take an all-of-society approach to help eliminate conversion practices. And I think that anyone who is a leader in religious settings, particularly because of this research, but broader than that, in any setting, if you've got some influence and you have some power to help your setting to become more inclusive and free from conversion practices, then please engage this research. Understand what survivors are saying. They are saying that conversion practices is tantamount to religious and spiritual abuse, and they even talk about a cult-like metaphor. And so this is really serious what they're saying, and we need to help find pathways, safe pathways, for people to escape or to exit these practices in a way that can keep their well-being intact. And all of us have got a job to help do that.
That was Andrea Famasanga speaking about the Human Rights Commission's role in supporting survivors of conversion practices in relation to Dr. Michael Rogowski's research article, Conversion Practices in Aotearoa, New Zealand, Developing a Holistic Response to Spiritual Abuse.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.